Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I'm joined by Rose, who shares her experience of how undiagnosed autism and ADHD impacted her eating disorder treatment. This episode really shines a light on why it's so important that we understand neurodiversity more and how this can impact the progression of someone's eating disorder and also can impact the treatment that they receive. I really hope that you enjoy this episode. Welcome to the Full of Beans podcast. It is so nice to have you on the podcast. How are you today?
I'm feeling good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm very good, thank you. I had a nice restful weekend, and that's not normally how I do weekends. So I feel really refreshed today. I'm like, I think I actually need to start doing this more often because I actually feel good rather than coming into the week tired.
That's really nice. I didn't have a restful weekend because I have a five-year-old, just a five-year-old who is currently breaking the generational trauma, and we're advocating for him, and he's currently in the process of getting a diagnosis of autism.
Wow, that is amazing. That's so cool to be breaking that chain. I feel like a lot of people are doing that with their kids at the moment.
Yeah,
that is very cool. And that will bring us nicely into the conversation that we're discussing today. So we're going to speak about undiagnosed neurodiversity and the link to eating disorders. I want to share a bit about your experience and how those two link together for you.
Yeah, so I always grew up thinking that I was different, knowing I was different, never quite fitting in anywhere and constantly getting things wrong, like socially wrong. And I think also, like I always had to, I never understood why I would always have to work so much harder than other people to get the same results, or usually higher, because I was a perfectionist and I overshot it. And so on paper, through like academic grades and things like that, I couldn't understand why I could be smart enough to get a PhD, but I couldn't remember to do basic tasks. And so there was all of this going on in the background, which kind of made me feel very out of control, not good enough. And I went through a series of, feel free to cut anything if it's triggering. I went through a series of different unhealthy behaviors to try and cope with it. So misusing medication, self-harm. And then I'd always like had this desire to lose weight, even though I was never overweight. Like I know that rationally I was never overweight, but that was the one that clicked the most and seemed less damaging and less embarrassing. So you misuse medication, sometimes you end up in A&E and that's embarrassing. You self-injure and people might see it and that's embarrassing, whereas it seems a lot more socially palatable to restrict your calories. And so that's what I did, and that's what stuck. So it was in a world that was I didn't feel in control of, and I couldn't understand why I was different. And the word I used time and time again in therapy, and was we could never get to the bottom of it, was that I was inherently flawed, just not quite a person. And this thing is a safety blanket. I mean, it's not, it's incredibly toxic, isn't it? But it felt like a safety blanket, that it was something to achieve every day. It was a backup plan for if I failed at other things I wanted to do. And it was something that I just felt totally in control of. But I think it was the undiagnosed neurodivergence that I couldn't understand why I couldn't do stuff, and the constant burnout and the constant pushing myself, like, you can do it. Everybody else can do it. You can do it. Mm-hmm. Put myself in situations that I shouldn't have been in, unsupported. And so it was that almost like, yeah, just like a child with my little boy has a blanket. Mm-hmm. He has a blankie. And I kind of think it's the same thing as my blankie. And you could take it everywhere and it was invisible. Well, it wasn't invisible, but the fact that you were doing it on purpose was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love that analogy to the blanket. And it's so funny that you say that, because I literally, throughout the whole time I have struggled, have referred to my disorder as a comfort blanket. And to be fair, when I was a child, I did have a blanket similar mm-hmm. to your son. And interestingly, I don't know why this made me think of it, but I also used to suck my thumb. And I remember, like, it was only a couple of months ago, I was having a conversation with someone and they were like, oh, why did you stop sucking your thumb? And I was like, well, the dentist told me that I had to, and that, you know, my teeth were going to be ruined if I continued sucking my thumb. And that kind of co-aligned with when my eating disorder started. So that makes so much sense to me in terms of the comfort from the blanket that then, you know, that wasn't socially acceptable. Like you said, that it's kind of embarrassing as a teenager to have a blanket. Mm. so the eating disorder developed. And I always said about how the eating disorder also was a comfort blanket to manage what I had as undiagnosed neurodiversity as well, because it just muted everything. And it, as you said, I love what you said about it, you could take it anywhere with you. And it was always a fallback. It was like, well, if everything else fails, at least I know I'm good at it.
And it's at least, and do you know what, weirdly, sort of sickly, toxically. So as well as having autism and ADHD, I have EUPD and I'm not one of the misdiagnosed ones. So I know a lot of people have the diagnosed EUPD and then they find out it's autism. That's not the case for me, I don't think. And according to the lady that diagnosed me with autism, I said, have I been misdiagnosed with EUPD? And she said, no, because there's so much that can't be explained by your autism and ADHD. And so I have very, very, very intense emotions. And the bottom line is, physiologically, to anyone listening, it's still not worth it because it's still a terribly addictive thing to do. And it's way better not to do dependent on it. But the bottom line is restricting your calories. For me, anyway, it slowed down my cognition. It made me numb and it genuinely did dampen those negative emotions. And that's a difficult thing. And you know, it's bad for you and it increases a whole other load of worry about different things. But in terms of managing acute distress, it worked for me as well. You can't think well enough.
Yeah. Just for the listeners, in case they've not heard of EUPD before, would you mind just explaining what it is and maybe in your experience or how you kind of experienced that?
Yes. So EUPD is emotionally unstable personality disorder. It sometimes, well, more historically was called borderline personality disorder. And for me, it is intense fear of abandonment, like feeling empty all the time. I experience dissociation, which it's very different for different people. But for me, it's like a loss of touch with reality and like I'm half in my body, but half not. And a level of neurosis that it's not psychosis, but it becomes like paranoia for me. And that you're kind of making stuff up in your head that feels incredibly real. And then afterwards, when that kind of has passed, you can see that it's irrational. You know, I mean, it's a lot more managed now than it was. I'm left with the intense anxiety. I think a lot of the time now I'm sort of in a situation that is almost like situational recovery. I wouldn't know what would happen. I wouldn't say I'm recovered from EPD, but I think the symptoms are well managed because of my life situation, in that I'm married to a therapist, so he's very understanding.
That helps, I'm sure.
Yeah, so I mean, he doesn't and wouldn't attempt to do therapy with me because I'm pretty sure that'd be very illegal. But he knows and understands. I think that goes a long way. So he doesn't sort of rise to it, and he knows how to communicate with me in a way that's helpful. But in the past, I did have very like, volatile and unstable relationships. Yeah, and that would obviously be a trigger. But I mean, EUPD is, they believe, caused by trauma, and I have no evidence of this, but I think my EUPD was caused by undiagnosed neurodivergence and the way I was treated by people who couldn't understand why I couldn't just do stuff. That's my personal reflection on my life. I think, yeah, this is.
Well, you know, I am no therapist, so I'm not qualified, but I do personally think that one, living with an eating disorder is traumatic. But also, you know, I think there's a lot of discussion around this within like communities in terms of autism and ADHD and what have you, undiagnosed neurodivergence. You go through the world in a very different way, I think, when you're undiagnosed. And I think, like you've said, that sort of internal battle of, why can't I do that? Why can't I just be like everyone else? Why can't I fit into that friendship group? Why can't I remember to do something? Like, I loved what you said there at the start. How can I have done a PhD but not be able to remember something? Like, for me, like, I find that it's just so contradictive in my own mind. So, and then also, you've got that internalized dialogue, but then also that externalized dialogue from other people, you know, whether it's healthcare professionals or family members or friends or colleagues not being able to understand. And I wondered if you'd mind sharing a bit more about kind of what happened for you in terms of that trauma when you were getting help or not help within healthcare.
So specifically within healthcare settings.
Any kind of that, you know, any kind of the trauma that you've experienced from the undiagnosed neurodivergence.
Well, I guess just growing up thinking I was flawed, like I'm not a proper person, there's something wrong with me, I don't know what. Trauma I've inflicted on myself in a way. So I can think of times where like I always felt like I was a bit frigid because I never really knew how to do the whole relationship thing. It's always felt frigid. And so, like, I would accept advances from people when I was younger. I mean, I hated nights out, like, with a passion. I hated it. I couldn't understand how other people could possibly like being in a sticky room where people are probably being sick, that smells weird, that people are like touching accidentally and deliberately, and there's bright lights, and there's no, it was hell on earth. But I'd go, and then if like a boy came onto me, I'd go with it. And I'd be thinking, please, God, no, I don't want to. But it's like, no, you need to stop being frigid. You need to stop being frigid. And so I've literally even done that. And it wasn't the boy's fault. But then I'd walk away feeling disgusted because I didn't feel anything for him. And I didn't feel anything for any of it. It was just to take your brain out of this situation and get on with it, because you have got to, at some point, get a grip and lose your virginity. And so even down to things like that was traumatic. And nobody did that to me. I did that to me. So I'm not blaming, like, the boys or anything like that at all. I consented, but it didn't feel that way. I felt like I was forcing myself to consent. So that was one thing, but it was just constant things like that, constantly agreeing to stuff I didn't really want to do, living an entirely false life. The only thing, this is incredibly traumatic, because the only thing I liked about myself was my grades. So I was always a high grade scorer, model student at school, and it felt like life or death. Like, my GCSEs felt like life or death, because if I didn't pass them, then if I didn't get what I wanted in them, then I might as well be dead, because that's all I had. And that is the other time when the eating disorder behavior started to crank up, because like, this is dangerous, this life or death sort of situation. Because it was like, I was so perfectionist that my GCSE results, I did get mainly A stars. And then I took extra subjects as well. I did a lot of GCSEs, and I dropped a couple of A stars down to A's, and I also got 2 B's. But the rest were A stars. And so most people would have been absolutely thrilled. And then I actually cried for about 4 days and didn't leave my bedroom. And it got to a point where I was thinking, I didn't even want to be here anymore because I didn't get straight A stars. I mean, that's, thinking back, an absolutely ridiculous situation, because one, they're GCSEs and nobody cares after a couple of years. And two, they're great results. Get over it. But I think a lot of this, everything, like the little things you like about yourself, you're feeling life or death, because it's all going to fall down if you don't keep hold of that. Because everything else that you're doing and behaving and interacting with the world is wrong. And that was the only thing I was getting right. I don't know if this is answering the question.
It definitely is, by the way. And also, when I'm smiling, I'm not smiling because I'm laughing at you.
No,
I'm smiling because I literally had exactly the same
feeling.
Yeah, the grade thing heavily relate to, like, for my A-levels, I was straight A student, going to get straight A's. But unfortunately, because I also was in the depth of anorexia at the time and was studying like 18-hour days, it got to exams and I was so burnt out that I got 2 A's and 2 B's. And
exact,
as you said,
same story.
The devastating
A-levels went to absolute part. Because I'd worked myself into the ground, I wasn't eating enough, I wasn't sleeping enough, I was self-harming all the time. And yeah, they went to pot. And obviously that then feeds the eating disorder, because you've got literally, when the only two things you're getting right in your entire life is controlling calories and getting good grades, you've not got a lot to go off, have you? In terms of like medically, I mean, there's other stuff that's traumatic. God, I could sit here for like 3 days and tell you about trauma from undiagnosed autism, even down to things like sleepovers and, God, why are you so attached to your mum and all of this. Like, I'm so attached to my mum. It is ridiculous, the level of attachment that I have to my mum. I'm mid-30s. I'm not going to give my complete identity away. I'm mid-30s, and I'm still like, if my mum goes on holiday, I'm like, okay, I need to get through this. And she has to ring me every day, and like, bless her heart. Yeah. But it was that. It was everything you do to make yourself comfortable makes you seem weird. So like, not being able to go to a party, didn't want to go to my friend's parties, that caused me massive anxiety. So I either went and suffered the anxiety, and I literally would worry about these things for weeks before. As soon as the invite came through, we're starting worrying, we're having sleepless nights, we're bedwetting, we're all of that. And I'm talking up to like teenagers. Or you don't go and you look weird, and then you're more left out and you're more ostracized, and you become more dependent on calorie restriction in grades. And so it's that cycle. But in terms of like medical stuff, I've had so many rounds of therapy, and I have had one. I had one practitioner years ago, literally over 10 years ago, a clinical psychologist, and she actually said to me, I think you're autistic. But I didn't really know what that meant. She didn't really explain what that meant to me. But she also didn't want me to pursue diagnosis. Because at the time she knew I wanted to either do the DCLIN or do a PhD in psychology. And she was like, we don't want to, you know, stigmatize. Yeah. So she didn't tell me not to, but she was, I mean, I think she did it with the best interests at heart, like what would be best for me kind of thing. And it was that discussion. And I think it was me that asked the question, could this prevent it? And she was like, yeah, maybe. So I didn't, because at this point I thought I would still be able to go and work in academia. In what way am I stable enough to be somebody else's therapist? I'm not. But there was still a potential in my head at that age. So I didn't pursue it. But then kind of as I got older, I think it's the not being believed. So I would turn up to appointments to try and get help. And people say to me, well, you, not really with the eating disorder, but, you know, for anxiety, massive anxiety. I think because I didn't have the words, because I mean, people with autism struggle with alexithymia. And I've still struggled with that. But at the time, I didn't realize. So I didn't sort of try to get around it in a different way. And I would turn up looking fine. So how are you? Absolutely fine. Yeah, great. So what's the problem? And I would just talk about it like it was a practical thing separate from me and not really express emotion. And then they'd be like, I can remember once like knowing that I needed some help because I was getting incredibly stressed about exams and I was starting to think about taking my own life if I didn't get what I wanted in the exams. And she was like, well, exam stress is normal. I'm like, yeah, exam stress is normal. Backup plan of suicide if you don't get straight A stars isn't. That's the bit that I'm concerned about. That's the bit I'm worried about. Not the, you know, exam stress, that bit. I kind of get that's everybody. It's that my backup plan isn't normal. My coping skills aren't normal. The fact that I can't go to school without scissors in my pocket isn't normal. But I didn't really have the words, I don't think. And I don't think clinicians sort of ask the right questions. Because I suppose if somebody wasn't autistic, they might be more likely to come out with this stuff and just say it.
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because, and this is just from my personal experience, but when you've lived in your own brain,
mm-hmm.
how do you know what a, you know, a neurotypical person experiences? How do you know that what you're thinking or your thought process yeah. is not actually the status quo? And I think for me, that was the biggest thing of like, I must just be really weak because everyone else seems to be able to manage this. Or like everyone at school, well, they don't really seem to care about their grades. So like they're fine and they're really cool because they're just so chill about everything. But yeah. actually, I want to get good grades. Therefore, I've got to keep pushing myself through. And I think that's the natural spiral that is so devastating for people because you get tired more quickly because you are so intense on everything you do. But then you think that you're weak because you're tired. So you push yourself harder
yeah.
and it continues like a spiral. And I think
exactly.
that's what makes it so difficult. But if you don't know that what you're doing is wrong or something that can be supported with different coping mechanisms, I did a podcast a couple of weeks ago and we were talking about like how recovery can be so contradictory in the fact that you want to recover, but you also want to engage in the behaviours. And how can you blame anyone when the only behaviours they know that help them and that work, if we're being realistic, is their eating disorder?
Thank you for saying that because so many people shy away from the fact that it works. I'm not saying it's a good thing.
Exactly. Would not wish it on my worst enemy.
No, but it works. I mean, there are way better coping mechanisms, way better. But the bottom line is if you haven't got them or you can't use them for whatever reason, it works. It does calm you down. It does make you feel more in control. It's just a fact. One thing I did want to mention was the autism was something that my mum suspected. And this is kind of like the dismissal and not being believed. And that's why I thought it was inherently flawed because I wasn't even sure I believed that psychologist said, I think you're autistic. Because when I was quite a small child, like preschool, my mum had the health visitor around. And I think she was coming to see my little sister. But she was like, oh, while you're here, can I just have a word? I'm going to start doing it now because I'm going to mention it. So I'm ticking. So the health visitor, I think she's autistic. I don't know why my mum came out with autism, but she said, I think she's autistic because she ticks all the time and she won't make eye contact during do it. And they said, no, she'll grow out of it. She's not autistic because, and I quote, girls can't get autism. Yeah, we can. We really can. Girls can't, it's a boy thing, actually. So yeah, based on my gender, I couldn't possibly be autistic. So that's kind of where it started. And then much more recently, I won't sort of like go through the whole thing because it's not like massively relevant, but it was an assessment for nearly a couple of years ago now. I was like, enough's enough. I want to be done with restricting calories on and off. So it's not a constant thing anymore. Like, as much, it is a little bit constant, but then it's only like, it turns on and kicks back into gear if something goes wrong or something might go wrong. So it's quite frequent, but it's not like what it was. And I thought, okay, I want to get a handle on this. So I went to the GP, had all of the, I won't mention numbers, but, you know, like the physical test done. And the GP was like, okay, yeah, we need to speak to somebody. We need to sort this out. Okay, great. Let's sort it out. Referral, see an eating disorder specialist. And she was saying all of this stuff. And the whole, I won't go through the whole thing because it's not directly relevant to neurodivergence. But a few things she did say is I actually brought up my functioning because I was like, my functioning's so low. Like, there's something really wrong with me that is beyond food. Because I remember saying to her, like, it's not always restriction. Like, sometimes I just don't eat. Sometimes I forget to eat because I don't really feel hunger. I feel empty, but I don't feel hungry. And empty is nice. So, and that's, I now know, thank you autism diagnosis, that that's an interception issue. So she was like, you can do, you don't forget to eat. It's like, no, I do. She's like, how can you forget to eat? Because I forget to eat. That's how. I just don't remember. What way do you want me to explain this? Like, I get like really hyper focused on stuff I'm worried about, and then food is just irrelevant. And then it becomes the most relevant thing in the entire world, i.e. not having it, when anxiety cranks up a gear. And she was suggesting this, that, and the other. And my mum was with me in the assessment, and she said, and I wasn't diagnosed either at this point with either autism or ADHD. And my mum was like, I don't think she's going to be able to do that because she's got ADHD. And we think she's got ADHD. She's on it. I'd done the screening and they said, like, likely, but you need to have the assessment. Spoiler alert, I have. You can probably tell just from this conversation and the amount of jumping about. But she laughed. The psychiatrist laughed. She actually laughed and said, she has not got ADHD. I've seen people with ADHD, and then she made like this movement, like, and they move all the time. I'm like, girl, my brain's moving at 100 miles an hour. Half of it is in this assessment. Half of it is in so many different places. Yeah, but I think like that scared me to a level. I was thinking, if I'm not neurodivergent, then I am just inherently flawed, and that's really bad. But it also scared me for other people, because it's like, what if someone had wondered and they were maybe thinking about getting an assessment, and that made them go, okay, well, you're a medical professional and you've just told me I haven't. That could stop them. And yeah, I mean, for me, I'm deciding not to go down the medication route for reasons including stimulants being appetite suppressants. So let's not go there. And I've never done that well on, and you can use SNRIs and stuff like that, but I've never done that. My concordance with medication isn't brilliant. But for some people, that could be life-changing. And so a statement like that, through just somebody not understanding what ADHD is and going with a stereotype, that could put somebody off getting the support that they really need.
Yeah. I think the stigmas that still exist, particularly from, you know, within healthcare where people should know better, is quite scary. And I actually went to a talk on autism in women last week. It was a seed talk, and it was super, super interesting. And I went with one of my best friends who's also neurodivergent. And just being in a situation where you and your best friend are kind of on the same wavelength, you both get each other, and you're hearing about women that get you, it was extraordinarily empowering. So I highly recommend it. But one thing that she discussed, which I found so validating, was that, so in your experience, you were told girls can't get autism.
Mm-hmm.
What she referred to was what they call the female form of autism. And I guess that's slightly more progressive, but misses the whole frigging fact that it's not based on gender. It is just a form, or it's just a group of characteristics that somebody has that falls under autism. And my friend, and I'm sure she won't mind me mentioning this, but her brother is autistic. And when he was diagnosed, they said, you've got the female form.
It's actually just his spectrum.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what his spectrum wheel looks like.
But I found it so interesting. So she had like a mind map of the different ways that that could show up. And so many of the things that you've said were on there in terms of like almost having stimming behaviors
mm-hmm.
that are normalized in society or are accepted in society. So for me, the eating disorder was a fantastic form of that because, you know, it was something that was socially accepted, but also like nail picking. Like my nails are absolutely.
I'm doing that right now.
Yes, literally.
Which time?
And that's what she said was another one. And then she was talking about things about how girls will go to school and they will do fantastic and they'll get incredible grades.
Yeah.
Then they fall apart at home because the mask comes down. And I don't know about you because it's not something that we've discussed, but just for the listeners in terms of if people are interested, she was also saying things like, you know, friendships, not being able to be within a large group of girls, but maybe yeah. having an intense friendship with one person. And therefore that then like meaning, I mean, that was my experience. I was very closely knitted with this one girl who was within a friendship group. So it almost looked like I was in the friendship group. I didn't give a shit about the other people in the friendship group. I just wanted to be her. And I hated if anyone else wanted to be her friend. And then they were also, she was speaking about things in terms of like obsessionality and how, you know, it might be that it seems like a normal obsession. Like mine was One Direction. I was absolutely obsessed. One Direction and Ollie Mers. But after about a month, no one cared about One Direction anymore. My obsession continued for 3 years and I knew every single thing about them. And so there were lots of different things that she was talking about. And I just was like, it's so interesting because similarly to what you said about ADHD, and I think it's similar with that in terms of how that shows up in women and girls, a lot of it is so internalized. And again, you know, this could be the case in men as well. I'm not just limiting this to girls and women. But I think that the more and more girls and women that I speak to about their experiences, a lot of it is going on in their head. They're too scared to talk about it because of the stigma. And then when they do then speak about it, they're like, we can't have ADHD, you don't move. We can't, you can't have autism, you're really sociable. You're like,
oh, there's that the thing as well though, like, oh, you're really sociable, or oh, you can do this, that and the other. So like, people are often shocked to find out that, I won't say what instrument because it's a weird one and it'll give my identity away, but I like music and I can stand in front of people and play my instrument. And yes, I have nerves, but what I'm actually doing is hiding behind it.
Yes.
I'm not playing. I'm thinking like, okay, I need to be at this. Like, I need to be at this. I need to engage with my community a little bit, you know, because my child wants to, my husband doesn't know how much he wants to because he's autistic as well. But yeah, it just feels like the right thing to do. Like, try and engage. Let's not become too reclusive, even though reclusive kind of feels quite good. I feel like I need to, you know, for my child. So it's like, okay, if I can play my instrument, I don't have to talk to people. So I'd much rather be, and like people said, like people that know me have said, like, how can you do that? But you can't go to a school event without like your mum or your sister coming with you. It's like, because they're not looking at me.
Mm.
They're listening to the instrument. Like, I'm hiding behind it. And so you can appear really, really confident. It's like, I could give presentations and not get overly worried about it. Nerves, yeah, but not worried. That's no way near as bad as a one-to-one doctor's appointment. Like, I had to go to the A&E. Not me. I'm fine. My son had to go to A&E because he'd had like he got a thing in his hand. He fell over, got a thing in his hand. Couldn't get it out, got infected, A&E, but it didn't need to go. It was seemed overkill for A&E because he was so little, because it was 4 at the time. And I was stressed because I was in a hospital environment, don't like hospital environments. There was noise, there was people. And they said, what's your son's name? And I was just like, in my head, that the words were just not there. And it was like, come on, all you have to do is speak. Date of birth? And I'm thinking, come on, girl, you were there. Say it. This isn't difficult. It's your child's date of birth. Nah, no. And so I just looked at my mum like, this is when you step in. Say his name and date of birth for me. And it's like, it doesn't add up, does it? How I can stand confidently or speak in front of people. Because when you're giving a presentation, you're not interacting. There's a script.
Yeah.
It's not you.
And also, I think that's one of the biggest things that is so difficult to come to terms with, but then once you get diagnosed you can come to terms with,
mm-hmm.
is it doesn't make sense. Like, none of it actually makes sense. How can I do, like, my mum will always joke to me, she's like, you are the most organized person I've ever met in my life, but your kitchen is a mess. How is that? Or like, you know, you can't get, you can't remember to take your laundry out or something like that. I'm like, if it made sense, I'd not be doing it, because it would actually make sense and I could sort it out. And why on some days am I able to do 1,200 million things, but then, you know, another day, all I can do is sit on the sofa and stare at the wall. Like, it doesn't make sense. But I think by having, I don't know what your experience has been, but for me, my experience has been by having that understanding of the reason I struggle with things is because I'm neurodivergent, and I therefore don't need the eating disorder to make things worse. It's actually making managing this quite a lot harder. And that for me has been where recovery has then stepped in. And I wondered if that had maybe been your experience, or has it?
Yeah, I wish I could say the same. In terms of, I guess in terms of like depressive symptoms, it's helped. So I've recently had a friendship breakdown and not gone through a lot of friendship breakdowns, because frankly, you have to have friends for that to happen. So not been a common thing. But I've had a friend, I think I've like accidentally unmasked a little bit, mm-hmm. like just as I got diagnosed. And I've also become really close with a girl who's ADHD as well. And we click like a house on fire. And
it happens.
Yeah. Well, we just met each other and we're like, where have you been all my life?
Mm-hmm.
So I think being close with her and her like acceptance with her, she had a really good understanding, and she just made me more okay with me, because she liked me for my autistic ADHD self, which is my actual unmasked self. And then I think through spending a lot of time with her, I started to unmask more. And basically, I think this particular friend didn't really like it. But I know in the past I'd have gone like, oh, this is because you're inherently flawed. This would have started a massive spiral. And I'm not saying I haven't struggled with it, because I have, feeling of like loss or even being a bit used. But the thing that's it, I can feel used, and I can feel almost like I'm actually okay with not being friends with you anymore. Whereas before, it would have been, this is because I'm a bad person, this is because I'm flawed, this is because I'm bad at friendships. And I think diagnosis have given me that. In terms of the eating disorder, oh, I'd love it to go away completely, but no, it's still, for me, it's still there. It's almost like that anxiety coping mechanism. But I don't think, much as I think it's massively related to being undiagnosed autistic ADHD, because I think that is the trauma that created the personality disorder. I think the eating disorder is maintained by the personality disorder and those massive emotions.
And it is hard, isn't it? I completely relate to the anorexia starving you of emotions. You know, it starves mm-hmm. you of food, but it also starves you of emotions. And that's so tricky when you then start feeling those emotions, particularly, you know, as someone that's neurodivergent, feeling emotions for me was an absolute overwhelm. And I actually, like over the past few weeks, I've been having a lot of like very intense emotions, not knowing what to do with them and just going into panic. And my friend suggested this app to me that you basically like track your emotions, and you click on it, and it's got like high energy, unpleasant, high energy, pleasant, low energy, unpleasant, and low energy, pleasant. Then you click into it, and then there's like 100 different emotions. I was like, who knew there was that many emotions? Like, what on earth? But actually, and that's made me realize, wow, you know, I did actually have a fundamental flaw in being able to communicate my emotions and feel them. So it is very scary. But I equally think that with the neurodivergence, I love what you were saying about those friendships. And I have had a lot of friendship breakups recently. And at the start, I was kind of sad about it. And then I just realized, no, I'm putting on a front for all these people. And if they're not going to accept me for my weird, wacky, unpredictable at times self, then they're not
good.
And it's hard, it is really hard. But I know a lot of my friends that I have stayed in contact with, which funnily enough, a lot of them are neurodiverse. So
I've got any neurotypical friends.
I literally said to my partner the other day, I was like, God, I've literally like, I have nothing against somebody that's neurotypical, please don't think I do, but I have all the neurotypical friends.
I think when, in my experience, is when you unmask and you stop making that effort to fit into what they want you to be, it just naturally stops and falls apart. And it's nothing to do with people with autism being better than people that are neurotypical. It's just that we're different and we're speaking a different social language and we've got different social values, and they're not right or wrong. Neither of us are right or wrong. It's just that I think autistic people click just like neurotypical people click.
Yeah, and especially when you've had your whole life feeling like you never quite clicked with somebody, and then finally you meet someone, you're like, oh my God. Like, and then someone will do something that I do and I'm like, why did you just do that? They're like, I do that too.
Yeah, And it makes you feel less weird. And it's more like, I guess it's like just being proud of who you are and it being acceptable. And there's something really lovely. Although like any friendship breakdown is sad, there's something really lovely about not having the pressure. Going back to the question, I've literally just ADHD round the houses 100 times. But in that way, it has helped because I've got more support. Because whereas before it would have been just an off the table thing, my secret that nobody knew about in the whole world, she'll be like, in a nice way, like, you look like you've lost weight, what can we do? Mm-hmm. Or you haven't eaten yet, what can we do? And if I say, oh, it's just because I'm not hungry, she's like, of course you're not, you don't feel hunger, but you still need to eat. So it's like helps those conversations and that understanding. So in that way, it does help because it gets me the right friendships and the right support.
Yeah. I think the thing is that it's very difficult because I think with any diagnosis comes a realization, and it's liberating to step into that and to be more like yourself. But ultimately, that might mean that some people don't now align with how you are and who you want to be. And I think, you know, what you just said there about your friend saying, oh, you know, have you eaten yet? And you're like, no, I'm not hungry. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's because you don't experience hunger. You know, just that validation, that understanding, rather than, what do you mean you don't feel hunger? That's so weird. Have you, that allows you to then be like, ah, I feel safe in this situation, and then you can be more open and honest about how you can be helped in the future,
and you've got a safety net. And so we're very much constantly having chats about like how we can support each other and support ourselves, and we're very lucky to have like very much like overlapping traits in some ways, but then different strengths. So mm-hmm. we can be like, oh, I can help you with that, I'll do that for you, and just pick up where on bits we find hard.
Yeah. No, I think that's lovely. And thank you so much for sharing your experience. I just want to finish, you know, you spoke there really nicely about like how friends have helped you and your family. If you could say to healthcare professionals one thing that, you know, if you could go back that they could do differently to help you, what would that be?
I think listen to people's truth. And if your patient is telling you, or their carer is telling you, that they think they're neurodivergent, drop your stereotypes, and that's okay. And it's okay to say you don't know and you don't understand, because we can't understand everything. But I know so many people who have been through multiple rounds of therapy that haven't worked. They've been misdiagnosed and it's come back to autism. And so I just think, get educated. And I think so many people are confident that they do know what it is. I thought I knew what it was. I mean, I've got a PhD in psychology. I'd done a lot of basic study on autism. I had a friend who was doing my PhD who was doing her PhD on autism. I thought I understood it, but I didn't understand it. Not until I got diagnosed, my husband got diagnosed, it became a special interest. And now I think I get it pretty well. But nobody's expecting you to know the answers, but don't be confident that you do if you don't. I think that is something that I would want to say, like the conviction of saying you haven't got ADHD because you don't move constantly. You can't be autistic because you're a girl. I mean, I think that's very much not the case anymore. I think that's pretty outdated and people don't believe that anymore. But time and time again, I'd hope that anyway, but time and time again, it's been dismissed because people have well-meaningly, I don't think anyone's ever done it on purpose, but well-meaningly made an assumption based on what they believe to be knowledge that is wrong. So I think just please, please, please get educated on autism, on ADHD, on all types of neurodivergence. And I think also, I would probably have an air of caution that if someone's in mental health services, particularly because of the high incidence of mood disorders in people with autism, just have that, are they, in the back of your mind when you're formulating, when you're, and ask the right questions and think, am I asking the question in the right way? Because I know for myself, I am very literal, I won't read between the lines. And if you ask how I'm feeling and it's a good day, I'll tell you I'm fine, even if yesterday I tried to kill myself. So just asking questions in a way that is, I guess, treat everybody like they might be until you know they're not.
And also, I think, you know, when, you know, you go and you say, oh, I think I might be autistic, like, what harm is it to do an assessment, like, or just to do a screening questionnaire or something to then see, rather than just a straight up no, like, do a screening assessment and then take it from there, rather than just, no, you know, you're not running around the room like a little boy, therefore you can't have ADHD, or you're female, or, well, you seem like you can hold a conversation, so you can't have autism.
Yeah.
So thank you so, so much. It's been such a pleasure to chat to you and hear all about your experience. So yeah, really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you too.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode. So be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.